Good morning. Welcome to Mid-Morning. I'm Catherine Lanfer. We're continuing our conversation about this historic and amazing presidential election. One big question is, when will it be over? We know that the Secretary of State in Florida has said the vote recount could be over by today. They could be announcing a winner by 5 p.m. or the close of today's business day. But does that really mean it's over with all the allegations of voter irregularities, not to mention perhaps a federal investigation, the calls for an investigation by the NAACP, the lawsuits that have already been filed? Is this any way to elect a president? We know that you have been inundated, just like we have, with all of these fast-breaking details. We thought we would take just a moment to try and figure out where exactly this episode fits in the history books. We're going to go to Calvin Gilson. He's a professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Southern Methodist University, and it's there that he directs the Tower Center for Political Studies. He joins us by phone from Texas. Professor Gilson, thanks for joining us.
Happy to do it, Catherine.
Now, we know that this is the closest election in generations, and I'm trying to keep track on the CNN monitor, and I'm not doing a very good job. It's a lot closer even now. How close is it, and how historic is it?
Well, it seems like among almost 100 million votes cast, we're down to a split of, last time I looked, maybe I don't even know how close it is nationally, but certainly very close. They're within 0.2 of 1%. And I know that the last election that was this close was 1876, the Hayes-Tilden election that ended Reconstruction. So it's been a while.
Now, when is the last time that we didn't know the winner of a presidential election more than a full day after the polls had closed?
Well, in 1960, there was certainly controversy for a period after the polls closed. That was the election between Richard Nixon and John Kennedy, and Kennedy won that election by about 113,000 votes nationally, and there were voting irregularities people pointed to in Chicago and in Texas, where Lyndon Johnson was a senator and also the vice presidential candidate that year. And what's interesting about that case is that President Eisenhower and many senior Republicans encouraged Richard Nixon to ask for a recount in that election with a particular focus on Chicago. And Richard Nixon, who we don't think of as the most honorable candidate for the presidency or president, declined to do that, saying that it would disrupt the popular perception of the integrity of elections and the nation needed to move on. And he declined to ask for a recount. So I think all we can hope for really is that these two gentlemen, Mr. Gore and Mr. Bush, have that same value placed on the system and its integrity.
Well, now that brings up the question of this automatic recount in Florida, because I've heard some discussion that suggests that if Al Gore had waived it, it wouldn't have happened.
I don't believe that's true. My understanding of that system in Florida, and I understand we may have the law dean from the University of Florida on later.
Yes.
My understanding of that situation is that it is a mandatory recount any time the votes are within one-half of 1%. And it may be that a candidate could stop it by actively asking that it not happen, but I think it is automatic. And, in fact, I think it's quite a good thing that it's going forward, and I think it's a good thing that it's an automatic computer-driven recount that will either confirm or lead to a change in that outcome that we can all depend upon. I'm glad it's not going to take several days to get done.
Well, but there is the question of the overseas absentee ballots and the legal challenges. When do you think we really will be done?
Well, it depends a little bit on what the spread is at the end of the automatic recount this afternoon. I understand that they're supposed to have that completed by close of business today, which is 5 o'clock. And if the vote spread is more than the number of outstanding overseas ballots thought to be still uncounted, then they might call it. But if the spread continues to narrow, as it has over the last day, from something like 1,743 votes at the end of the original count down to something like 900 when they picked up the recount this morning, I think they may well have to wait for several days. I think at the longest, it could be 8 or 9 days. Those overseas ballots have 10 days after Election Day in order to arrive. But a lot of them are already in and I think are being included in this count. So the number of outstanding overseas ballots should be declining over the coming days. So it's hard to know exactly when we'll get a firm call on this election. It could be the end of business today. It could be a few more days before we get it.
Now, we know that Gore's campaign has been considering whether to mount a legal challenge, following those allegations of voter irregularities. What do you think Vice President Gore should do if the recount gives victory to Bush?
Yeah, that is a very difficult question to look at it broadly. In a national election where you have 100 million votes being cast, you're going to get reports of irregularities of various sorts, so that there was a dispute in St. Louis on the election evening when there were long lines of people still waiting to vote. The polls were supposed to close, and a judge said, keep them open and let these people vote. And then others pointed out that, well, they're not open in the rest of Missouri, so why would they stay open in St. Louis? And a second judge came in and had them closed. There's the story about Democratic get-out-the-vote people giving packs of cigarettes to homeless men in Milwaukee to do same-day registration and then to vote. And the worst case is the one down in Palm Beach County in Florida, where an ambiguous ballot may have led to as many as 19,000 ballots being disqualified when the people voting became confused and marked two holes, one for Al Gore and another for Buchanan, because the ballot was set up in a way that that apparently confused them. That, I think, is a separate issue from the sort of normal stuff that goes on in a very big election. But once the votes are cast and the connection between the ballot and the person who cast it is broken, it is very difficult to see what could be done. It's hard to imagine that you would go ahead and do a recount within Palm Beach County while the rest of the country watched. And if you did, then you would probably have to permit those to vote who voted the first time, and we have their names because they had to sign in. So I really hope that that doesn't happen. I hope the NAACP and the Gore people don't file court challenges and we get the best outcome we can, knowing that it will never be perfect.
All right. Let's go take a call. We've got Lisa calling us from Lakeville. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hi.
Hi.
My question is that why something as important as a presidential election ballot isn't standardized? I mean, we have state and federal tax forms. Why not state and federal voting ballots?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. The ballots, of course, are vetted by representatives of the political parties. So even in Palm Beach County, people did look over this ballot and approve it before it was used. I guess the difficulty with a national ballot is that most voting rules and regulations, how the election is conducted, is a state prerogative. The states make those rules and they develop their own ballots. And obviously in a presidential election, you're going to have a national question, then there'll be lots of state and local offices all the way down the ballot. So it would be nice if we could get some visibly workable, clear kind of ballot, but I don't imagine it would end up being a national ballot.
We're talking to Calvin Gilson. He's director of the Tower Center for Political Studies at Southern Methodist University, where he's also the chair of the Department of Political Science. We hope a little later to be talking to John Mills. He's the dean of the law school at the University of Florida. And, of course, we hope to be talking to you about this amazing presidential election. 1-800-242-2828 in the Twin Cities. It's 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. We are going to go to Susan in Duluth. Susan, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Thank you.
Yes.
My question is two-part. I know all of our attention is being focused on Florida right now. I'm wondering if other states that were close are being considered as far as having a recount. Also, I'm wondering if investigations aren't being done in other states where there were irregularities as well.
There are some inquiries taking place and charges being made. I spent an hour on Wisconsin Public Radio yesterday, and as I'm sure you know, that election turned on 1,200 votes statewide. So the presidential candidates were very, very close, Al Gore did manage to squeak that out, but Ralph Nader had about 3%, I think it was, in Wisconsin. So there you've got a situation where 1,200 votes statewide decided that election. And I think Iowa was just as close. In fact, there is a county in Iowa that had an absolute dead tie at something like 10,045 votes to 10,045 votes, or maybe it was 1,045 to 1,045, but whatever it was, an absolute tie. So there are some states where it was very close, so close in Oregon that they still haven't completely decided that that election. So if we begin to have court cases at the state level in Iowa, Wisconsin, Florida, and other kinds of challenges to this, it really can spiral out of control, because when you have an election with 100 million ballots, there are minor league shenanigans going on all over the country, and it's hard to sort all of them out after the fact. The one really big issue, I think, will come in Florida, what to make of what happened in Palm Beach County.
Let's go to Jonathan in Minneapolis. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hi, thanks. I have a question about the ballots in Palm Beach. I heard that they had sample ballots that were mailed out previous to the election, and obviously they were approved by, you know, different representatives that had to approve the ballots. And I just wondered, and I also heard that there's no complaints about the ballots being confusing prior to the election. Is that true or not?
You know what? We have John Mills with us now. Why don't we go ahead and see if perhaps he has an answer for that? John Mills, who is dean of the law school at the University of Florida. Dean, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
Now, could you hear that question on the sample ballots?
Yes, I could.
All right. Do you have a response for our caller?
I don't know if there were complaints beforehand. There were complaints, obviously, during the day. I guess the actual legal issue that will have to be resolved at some point is the configuration of the ballot itself, whether it complies with Florida law.
Now,
that's sort of a two-part test.
Now, I know that you think that many commentators, just many consumers of the media, are missing the point about the controversy over those ballots in Palm Beach. What are we getting wrong?
Well, I hear a lot of folks saying, well, gee, it's confusing, or I marked my ballot incorrectly, et cetera. And it is, there are lots of ballots maybe across the country that are confusing, and there are lots of people who may have marked their ballots incorrectly. That's not a legally sufficient reason to reexamine an election. The question here is whether the actual ballot in Palm Beach, which has now, I think, been rather widely circulated, complies with the Florida statutes, which define a form. And if they don't, then there's another provision of the Florida law which says if you have received illegal votes and counted them sufficient to change the results of the election, then the election shouldn't be, in that jurisdiction, shouldn't be certified. So there are two questions. Are there illegal votes and sufficient to change the result of the election? That's important because the goal of all these election statutes is to reflect the will of the public. So, in other words, if there were just a few illegal votes that could not change the result of the election, the courts and even the statute would say, let the election stand, because that reflects the will of the people.
Just to clarify here, so you're saying that the configuration of the ballot, it might have confused people, but that doesn't make it illegal.
Right.
All right.
What makes it illegal is the Florida statutes, which define what could make it illegal. I mean, this is going to be actual legal controversy.
All right. So, in other words, we know that there are legal challenges to the vote in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those challenges addressing specifically Palm Beach County.
Mm-hmm.
I guess where I'm getting confused here is it sounds like what you're saying is, look, if people make honest mistakes because the ballot confused them, that's not illegal, and that doesn't mean we should throw out the vote.
That's what I said.
Okay, well, I just wanted to make sure. We use words like certify.
Because the difference is, yeah, and I think that's where there's some confusion.
Okay, so then
the ballot itself is illegal, which is, in this case, there are two allegations.
I'm going to stop you. Who's saying that this ballot is illegal? I've only heard that it's confusing.
The people who filed the lawsuit.
Okay. They're saying that it was so confusing it's now illegal.
Well, actually, I know this is possibly a confusing statement.
Who's on first, Dean?
But the fact that it's confusing is not the issue, but it's probably evidence of why the statute as legally described in Florida should be the form. In other words, what this particular form does is rather than put your actual vote on the right of each candidate, it puts it in the center among candidates on both sides of a page, which you probably have seen.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard to tell which person you're voting for. Now, that's a confusing issue.
Right.
But the fact that it's in the middle of the page rather than on the right side of the page with one column is a legal issue. And the second issue is the second hole down on which you vote. In Florida, in most places, the two major parties are the first two slots. The second slot in this ballot is actually Buchanan.
Right. I have all that. And, you know, it's so hard to be talking about a visual image on radio.
It's very tough. But, I mean, the issue is there are going to be a couple questions on the legal sufficiency of that ballot.
Right. So people are saying, I don't think this ballot is legally binding because of its design. And your point is it might have been confusing, but that doesn't make it illegal.
Right.
Okay.
But if it's illegal and confusing, then you have a legal challenge that's supported by the fact that it is confusing.
Well, you know, I'm going to stop this conversation because I'm getting dizzy just sitting up here in Minnesota. What I'm trying to understand is, what do you think we're not getting here? Because they're already doing the recount. I mean, isn't part of this conversation moot?
Well, not if those, if the votes in Palm Beach County
mm-hmm.
are illegal, and they are sufficient to change the results of the election, then they should either be thrown out and there should be some consideration of a remedy. Now, keep in mind, you've heard all the stuff about the potentially wrong votes for Buchanan, and you've probably heard about 18,000 votes being thrown out.
Mm-hmm.
If you believe, and if someone concludes, that those ballots are illegal, you may have had a situation which Al Gore won Florida by 5,000 votes, which may be why the exit polls said what they said. I mean, people who walked out who actually voted for Pat Buchanan thought they voted for Al Gore. People who walked out and had their ballot disqualified thought they voted for Al Gore.
Professor Gilson, you want to weigh in here?
Well, I'd like to just ask Dean Mills a question, because I think that it's fairly clear that the number of votes in dispute in Palm Beach County are sufficient to change the outcome of the election. So the question then is, if they are found to be illegal because the ballot form was did not comport with Florida law, what is the result of that? Just that you decertify those and don't count them? Or is it possible that you could be required to hold a new balloting among those who voted the first time in Palm Beach County? See, if you don't count them, that's one outcome. If you have to have a new election, that's another outcome.
Well, that's where this gets really tough. The statute says that a circuit court judge can fashion an appropriate remedy.
Yeah.
So there have been, of course, elections in Florida that have been thrown out. We in Miami. A couple of elections were thrown out based on fraud. And again, this isn't fraud.
Is it your impression that the ballot form will, in the end, comport with Florida law? Because my sense has been so far that was the case, that the ballot form may well be confusing, and as you described, you vote by hole-punching down the middle from candidates on either side. And at the top left, just to try to be visual about it, at the top left was Bush, and then across from him on the top right was Buchanan, and below Bush was Al Gore. And
mm-hmm.
so there's a sense in which it was either second or third. It's supposed to be second. Is your sense that the ballot form will, in fact, be declared to be legal?
At that point, we're in sheer speculation. It says substantially comply,
mm-hmm.
and that is a legal question. And That's the threshold. I mean, I look at it and I think you can make an argument that substantial compliance would be something which generally would be a form that would allow you to make your votes to the right, and in which the president and vice presidential candidates, the top two parties, were the top two.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in any form you wanted to do that. But it's very interesting to me because, of course, the legal question is actually probably dispositive here. And the confusion, I guess one could say, well, the confusion demonstrates why ballots should be in a given form.
Now, when we're, as you were saying earlier, just because a ballot is confusing doesn't necessarily make it illegal. There are legal challenges now saying, yes, this ballot was so confusing, we should come up with some sort of remedy. If these legal challenges continue, and it is up to a state judge to come up with some sort of remedy, how effective really an election is it if we have a local state judge determining the fate of a national presidential election? Dean Mills?
It's not a good situation. The interesting thing is, in looking at the situation, federal law, I guess as some of the other folks on the phone know, delegates to the state most election processes. Well, you can violate it, and if you violate it, the federal government will prosecute you or demand there be new elections. And I don't know, there may be allegations out there now about federal violations, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about a state standard. And I kind of wonder about this. I mean, I know everybody is concerned, but I mean, this is election for the President of the United States, and if we were to send observers to a third world country and we said, well, the election is going to turn on illegal ballots in some small province, but it's just too much trouble. We're just going to let the, I think we need to get it right, and we particularly need to get it right, whatever that result is, because of the closeness of the election. The American public, I don't think, wants to think that you had some legally invalid votes that decided the election.
All right, Dean Mills, before you go, just once again, tell the point that you think people are overlooking. I just want to make sure we get that through to people.
Well, the challenge is to the actual legality of the votes. I mean, and the confusion is perhaps some evidence as to why a legal form was developed. If, in fact, the fact that I'm confused when I go into my election booth is probably not going to result in any effective legal challenge.
Mm-hmm.
But if the printed ballots are found to be out of compliance, that is a legal challenge.
All right. John Mills, I want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
John Mills is Dean of the Law School at the University of Florida. We're continuing our conversation with Calvin Gilson. He's professor and chair of the Department of Political Science and director of the Tower Center for Political Studies at Southern Methodist University in Texas. And, of course, we'd like you to join us. The lines are full, but take down these numbers. You can join us in a few minutes, 1-800-242-2828. In the Twin Cities, 651-227-6000. Do want to let you know that by now, CNN is reporting that the Bush lead in the Florida recount has now shrunk down to 799 votes. And we'll find out a lot more. We're going to turn to Stephen John. He's standing by with the latest from the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom.
Thank you, Catherine. New violence in the Mideast is clouding today's scheduled meeting between President Clinton and Yasser Arafat in Washington. An Israeli rocket attack on a group of Palestinian commanders killed one and critically wounded another. Arafat wants an international force to protect his people. A top Russian official says divers have retrieved a ship's log and more written material from the sunken nuclear submarine Kursk. Earlier, they found two notes written by sailors as they were trapped in a rear compartment of the submarine. The notes told of poison gas from fires and pressure mounting in the compartment. Doctors in London say the baby surgically separated from her twin is making a rapid recovery and is breathing without a ventilator. The three-month-old girl was surgically separated from her twin Monday. The weaker twin died during the operation. The president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis says the outlook is bright for the U.S. economy no matter who claims the presidency in the coming days. Gary Stern says the tight races for the White House and Congress might also reduce the chance of dramatic tax cuts or other policy changes that could alter the nation's economy. Senator Rod Graham's lost the election, but he's about to gain a wife. The Anoka County Vital Statistics Office confirms that Grahams and longtime aide Christine Gunnis have filed for a marriage license. Grahams has confirmed the engagement but declined to give any details. A 24-hour vigil in honor of Veterans Day and American POWs and MIAs begins at noon today at the University of St. Thomas. Air Force, Navy, and Army ROTC cadets will march past the flag in the quadrangle of the St. Paul campus. Meanwhile, the Minneapolis Veterans Medical Center is holding a Veterans Appreciation Day health fair today. Today in weather, mostly cloudy, a few flurries, highs from the mid-20s to the mid-30s, a chance of light snow in the northwest overnight tonight, and continued cold tomorrow. In Brainerd this hour, it's 28 degrees. Mankato has 27. In Rochester, 29 and 29 in the Twin Cities. That's a news update from Minnesota Public Radio.
Financial support for our programming comes in part from the new and renewing members of Minnesota Public Radio.
Hello, I'm Bill Kling, president of NPR. Over the years, you've told us we've become the best source of radio for adult audiences. We tell you about important issues. We do it with depth, balance, integrity, and accuracy. Many of you tell us that you learn from our broadcasts, that you stay tuned longer than planned, and that you make daily decisions from what you hear. When I started with NPR, there was no public radio. We built it, and we built it with the support of listeners. People trusted us, invested in us, and now you hear the result of that each day. We're proud of those of you who became early supporters. Together, we've created something so significant that it would be hard to imagine not having it. This has been a good year for many of you, and I hope you'll make it a priority to become a supporter of public radio during this year's membership drive. We need your support. We've got even more opportunities and challenges than ever. Consider the true value of NPR and become a member or increase your membership level this year. Thanks.
I'm Catherine Lanfer. You're listening to Mid-Morning. We're continuing our conversation with Calvin Gilson, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science and director of the Tower Center for Political Studies at Southern Methodist University. Professor Gilson, talk for a minute about how you think this election and the limbo we're in has affected the country just in the past 24 hours. And what's it going to be like if this goes on for a lot longer?
Yeah, I think that the country has taken this in stride. There, everybody seems a little mesmerized by it and almost bemused as opposed to worried. And that is a very good thing. We don't have extra police on the streets. We don't have armored personnel carriers rolling up to our public buildings. People are comfortable that this will be resolved, and they're waiting for assurance that it's resolved fairly. So I think that's positive. What is not positive is it is very difficult to see from this point how either one of these men, should Al Gore or George W. Bush be declared the winner of this race, how they get back the election night enthusiasm. Think of what this would have been if one of them had won and they stood before their supporters and with great energy and enthusiasm described moving into the transition, moving into the presidency, developing an agenda to put through the Congress in the early months. Even a close election can result in some real momentum and movement for one political party or the other. But these guys are both becalmed at this point. They're dead in the water, and they will have to gin up the enthusiasm and get moving into a transition in the first part of an administration facing a Congress that is just as closely divided as is this presidential race. So it's hard to see either of these guys developing enough momentum to have much effect in the early days of their presidency.
Now, this closely divided Congress, this closely divided vote, what exactly is that saying about the electorate?
Well, I think people have different takes on that. Some people find it worrisome that we are a nation divided. And I think if you look at the electoral maps that you see on the television stations or in your newspapers or that we talk about here on the radio, it does suggest a stark division between the coast, the West Coast, and the East Coast down as far as Maryland and, and the heartland of the country, the High Plains, the Mountain West, down through the South. Oftentimes the Gore states will be in blue and the Bush states will be in red, and it looks like a very stark division of the country on geographical boundaries. But I tend to take a less bleak view of it and to think that after 8 years of steady economic growth, that people are generally fairly satisfied with their own circumstances and their own future prospects, and that they don't see a tremendous difference between these two candidates. There would be policy differences, say, on tax cuts or those kinds of issues, how you handle education reform, but for the vast majority of Americans, they feel like they would do fine under either circumstances, even if the direction were somewhat different.
Let's go to Bob in Minneapolis. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Good morning. Thank you. What a fascinating topic. I had a couple of comments. Last night, I had not seen this ballot that it was what everybody is talking about, and I was watching the news with my 11-year-old son, and he was listening to it intently, and he saw the ballot on the screen, and he said, "Well, duh, all you have to do is follow the arrow and push out the hole. What's so tough about this?" Or punch the hole next to the arrow. So I thought that was very interesting that an 11-year-old would look at it and say, "I don't see anything confusing about this." And I think, I don't know about you, but I voted on that form before. Did I like it? No, not necessarily, but I, you know, it's not like the first time this form's ever been used. Second comment, and this hasn't been mentioned much since the first hour, but people are talking about, you know, bags of votes disappearing and boxes of votes disappearing and this whole conspiracy theory. And I find it kind of interesting because in any polling place, in any voting place, there are Democratic and there are Republican election judges. And I believe that every single step of the process is closely monitored by both sides, both parties. So there would have to be some kind of massive collusion for any kind of the other things that have been allegated to have taken place, to have actually taken place. And my last comment is regarding the revote. I think it's just a huge, big, bad idea. Because as the professor mentioned earlier, there are a lot of other states that were very, very close that went in Gore's favor versus Bush's favor. And what would stop the electorate in those states from saying, "Hey, you know, we want to take another shot at this also"?
All right. Thanks. Professor?
Yeah, I think my eyes were sharper when I was 11. The last 40 years have degraded a lot of my senses. So I think that a lot of the people who voted in Palm Beach County were elderly. And the ballot, I have my newspaper, New York Times, here open in front of me. It does have the two holes that you punch out. It would be relatively easy, I think, to make a mistake, and it's a shame that it happened. But as the dean of the Florida Law School said a few minutes ago, it's hard to know what the appropriate remedy for that would be. But I do agree with Bob that this is a can of worms, and if you open it up, I guess the image is more like pulling a string. You could just keep pulling on it for quite a while in this electoral process.
Let's go to Dale in Roseville. Dale, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, I have an interesting solution for your problem.
Mm-hmm.
As the nation was split almost 50-50 for Bush and Gore, why not let each man serve 2 years of the presidency and be decided at a coin toss of who serve first? And at the end of these 4 years, abolishing the Electoral College, we would then have a popular vote to decide which man should serve the next years.
All right, Dale, we'll turn that over. You want to throw that to your next class, Professor Gilson?
Yeah, maybe so. That's an interesting idea. It's not something that's going to happen, but I think that we do face something that is not completely dissimilar to that in the United States Senate right now, depending upon how the last seat out in Oregon goes and whether or not Al Gore and Joe Lieberman become president and vice president, which would clear out a Democratic seat in Connecticut and a Republican would be appointed to it. It's still possible for a 50-50 tie in the Senate to be then broken by the vice president. But Tom Daschle, who is now the minority leader or the Democratic leader in the Senate, has suggested that if it is a tie, what they do is divide up the committee chairmanships and subcommittee chairmanships and have some kind of shared governance. So that might work in the Senate because of the internal dynamics of that body right now. The way it normally works is very collegial. So it's possible there. I think that we will come to a resolution where one man or the other is president, and then we will have a serious discussion of the Electoral College and what the benefits are that it brings and what the deficiencies are that come along with those benefits.
Let's go to Julie in St. Paul. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hi. I would say I'd have to differ with the speaker on diminishing the effect this is having on the American public. True, we're not going to violence. We're not rioting in the streets as of yet anyway. But, for example, I'm at work. I really probably shouldn't be listening to Mid-Morning and making phone calls, but productivity is being affected, I think. It's consuming. The American public is on hold, so to speak. And I think the limbo, the questions yet unanswered, are having a great effect.
Thanks for your call, Julie. Oh, Julie, hang on. What if this went on for another 10 days?
I think the effect would be greater. I would also, with some of the racial questions being considered in Florida, I think there is potential for violence over this issue.
Thank you, Julie. Professor?
Yeah, I think if it does go on for an extended period of time and additional questions are raised, Jesse Jackson and Kwame Nkrumah going to Florida and raising questions about whether there were racial difficulties involved, people not being allowed to vote or told that there were no more ballots left or that the polling place was closed, that could create some longer-term difficulty. But I do think that the American people are sort of calm enough at this point to let this process run its natural course. I think the Super Bowl distracts people and reduces productivity. So we tend to get over that in a couple of days. And I think the integrity of the process here is to be defended. We need to get a decision as expeditiously as we can, and then we need to recognize what are tangential issues that would not affect the outcome and not let them hold up the process. Like I very much hope we don't end up in the courts of Florida or in the federal district courts over this election.
How likely do you think it is that we will not end up in court?
Well, I think that there will be various parties who will attempt to file suit, but I think it's quite possible that they will be found not to have standing. What that means is, and I guess we need Dean Mills probably here, you can't just go into court and file a suit because you don't like something that happened. You have to be integrally involved in it yourself. In fact, you have to have experienced harm as a result of the thing that you're complaining about. So only people who have standing can file suit. That's why they found three people from Palm Beach County to file the suit that is being backed, I think, by the NAACP. But it may well be found to be a political question not subject to legal remedy, and I would not be surprised to have that be the case.
A reminder, we're talking to Calvin Gilson. He is director of the Tower Center for Political Studies at Southern Methodist University in Texas. If you'd like to join this conversation, the lines are full right now, but it's 1-800-242-2828 in the Twin Cities. It's 651-227-6000. Take down those numbers, and you can join us in a minute or so. Let's go to Barbara in Edina. Barbara, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hi. I think basically the whole system of voting, particularly in a national election, is flawed. I was an election judge in Edina. When I went to the training session, the person training us in said that we had to vote two sides of the ballot. And I thought, no. So I raised my hand and I said, I think it is correct to say that there are two sides to the ballot. You can vote as little or as much as you want to. And so that point was made. And I went again for another try at this, another year, and the same thing was said. And I just think that to improve improve that situation, as in many situations, there should be a standard. I don't think each individual election judge should be saying what they think. I think something should be written down, agreed on by both parties. So I just think the whole system, particularly now when you see how close the country is divided, is really flawed for getting an accurate vote.
Yeah, I think that the democracy is a messy process. With as many people involved in the outcome as we have, there are going to be deficiencies, things that we would prefer to have come out otherwise. And it is entirely possible that regular citizens acting as instructors in the electoral process are going to misstate exactly what the rules are and say you have to vote both sides of the ballot, whereas the caller, Barbara, was exactly right. You can vote for just the president and then move on, or vote, skip along and vote for someone, not others. And I think those kinds of things are always going to be attendant to a democratic electoral process where you have regular citizens with a little bit of light training administering the process. But if we find that something systematic was wrong in Palm Beach County, that's really where the problem comes in, I think. And hopefully we'll be able to find that out and resolve it relatively quickly.
The CNN monitor now says that George Bush is leading in this recount by 830. I want to go back to this question of what should Al Gore do if it turns out that Bush wins this recount?
Well, what Al Gore should do is show the sort of integrity that we would have hoped George W. Bush would show if the shoe were on the other foot, and that was really what was expected to happen going into this election. Knowing that it was close, people expected that George W. Bush stood a good chance of winning the popular vote but might well lose the Electoral College vote. And I always go back to the response of Richard Nixon to the 1960 election, where there was reasonable evidence / suggestion that there had been illegal vote tampering in Chicago. Mayor Daley and his cronies, lots of people thought, had secured enough illegitimate votes to swing Illinois to Kennedy and therefore swing the election to him.
There was some irony in having his son come out to announce in front of the Gore headquarters that...
Yeah. Yeah, there was. But I really do think that our electoral system has come a very long way in the last 40 years, and we have little overt corruption. We have some mistakes, and we have some people saying things that aren't exactly true, but it's a much cleaner process. And when President Eisenhower encouraged Richard Nixon to call for a recount in that election, Nixon declined to do so on the grounds that it would be too disruptive to the democratic process and would reduce people's confidence in that process, and he was going to take the results as stated. And I think that's what Al Gore should do as well. And if the shoe had been on the other foot, as it was expected a couple of weeks ago, that would have been the assumption for George W. Bush as well.
If it was so disruptive 40 years ago, why is this not disruptive right now?
What Nixon thought was that if we went to a national recount, sort of redid the election, or even required a new election in Chicago, that would have been disruptive. And what I'm saying is I do think that if we were to re-vote in Palm Beach County, stretch this out for a couple of weeks, that would be very unfortunate. Hopefully we'll be able to resolve the issues there and make a decision about who won without having either lawsuits or re-voting ordered by some judge.
Let's go to Don in Coon Rapids. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Thank you. I have actually two questions and concerns. My first question is how come if they're so into this electoral vote, they don't divide them? If the one gets like X amount, like 51% of the votes, the other one gets 45, somehow divide the electoral votes? And my other question is if they're so concerned with everybody getting out there to voting, but yet the popular vote's not going to win the presidency, what good is it for some people thinking, well, why should I vote then?
Yeah, those are good points. As Don is suggesting, the way the Electoral College works now is if a candidate wins the most votes in a state, whether they win that state by one vote or 100 votes, it might be 50.1 to 49.9. The guy with 50.1 gets all the electoral votes for that state. in two states, Maine and Nebraska, they have winner-take-all by congressional district, so that if you get the majority in a congressional district, you get the electoral votes assigned to that district. And so a state could split its electoral votes. And if we do go to a discussion about reforming the Electoral College, I doubt that we'll set the college aside completely and go to straight popular voting. But we might well go to some system that comes closer to what Don was describing, and a congressional district winner-take-all reform, I think, would be possible.
Let's go to Stephanie in Minneapolis. Stephanie, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hi, I have a comment. I heard the speaker refer to or comparing this election to the Super Bowl, and I also heard another commentator this morning talking about this election in terms of sporting events and kind of the suspense and drama. And my comment is that as we know, this is a very serious issue that affects, you know, groups of people depending on the outcome. And I think it is more significant than the drama of such an event.
All right. Thanks, Stephanie. Professor?
Oh, yeah, there's no question about that. The point was not that there was some equivalence between a sporting event like the Super Bowl and the election of a president, but that lots of things distract the American workforce and lead to declines in productivity, and it doesn't affect the economy enough to worry about. So what I was saying is, if people are standing around the water cooler talking about this presidential election and how it stands right now, and that's reducing productivity, that's not something that I would be very much worried about, any more than I would be worried if they were standing around the water cooler talking about the Super Bowl. But you're right, it is very serious business, and that's why you approach it systematically and try to work through the concerns and difficulties that have arisen in a public way that inspires confidence and still results in a decision in a timely manner. And I would go back and make one additional point to Don, the previous caller, about turnout. That was, I think, an important issue. We did experience an increase in turnout, although a small one this time. I think we're back above 50%. But in that Kennedy election I talked about a while ago, we were at 63%. And throughout most of the 19th century, turnout of a smaller restricted electorate, white men, was up around 80%. So turnout is very important, and I think this election shows very, very clearly how important one or two votes or one vote per precinct statewide can be. So I think it's very important for people to vote, and that's a civics lesson that'll probably be pretty easy to teach with this election as an example.
Let's go to Stuart in Lindstrom. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Good morning. Yeah, I'm just kind of confused as to why is it in the United States they don't have a national ballot, as in a lot of European nations, the style at least, is the same from region to region. Seems a little bit silly that these things get picked, you know, in terms of from county to county here. One district can have it fill in the black arrow, and the other one is punch a card. I don't understand why there's no uniformity.
Yeah, that's a very good question, and there is an answer, and whether people find it to be sufficient is an open question. We'll see. In Europe, a lot of countries are what are called unitary systems, like France, where you would have from the center, from Paris, a uniform ballot that would be used throughout the country. The U.S. is a federal system, and that means that there is a division of sovereign authority between the national government and state governments, and that division of authority leaves the states in charge of the process of election, and even in charge of selection originally of state senators, for example. So I think that it is American federalism that results in more authority in the states over a wider range of matters than is familiar in many European countries. And it's something that we feel like we do pay a cost in efficiency for federalism, but we also receive some benefits, and the principle of those are local control of important issues in the communities that people live in. But there's no question that it is, in some sense, more efficient to run a unitary political system, but that's not what we've chosen to do over this country's history.
What impact do you think this is going to have on the race in 2004?
That is very interesting, because I have been thinking about it over the last couple of days in terms of the future of Al Gore, because I think as this process works itself out, even though the margin that Governor Bush enjoys in Florida is coming down, is in the high 800s now, or I guess back up to 930 or something, those overseas ballots coming in, I think, will probably be enough to float him to a margin, assuming that the stuff in Palm Beach County doesn't disrupt that. So I guess I still expect George W. Bush to be president and have real difficulties in performing that job over the next 4 years with Congress being so closely split. But if there is, I think, a sense in which Al Gore, who during the campaign was frequently criticized, if not denigrated, for having a personality that could not connect with the American people, clearly being very knowledgeable and being expert on all kinds of policy issues, but not making that emotional connection with the American people. If he comes out of this having won more popular votes than George W. Bush, who becomes president because he gets a majority in the Electoral College, I think that will make Al Gore the titular and emotional leader of the Democratic Party for the next 4 years. And he might well come back and run for president again in 2004 if he's cleanly defeated, if he had been cleanly defeated in 2000 because of the concern about this inability to make an emotional connection with the American people. He would have been out of the public spotlight and probably not an effective candidate in the future. But I think Al Gore is probably, if he's not president, is going to be the leader of the Democratic Party for the next 4 years.
And so how he responds to this recount could well set him up for the race in 2004.
Absolutely. I think both of these men, Al Gore and George W. Bush, need to understand the gravity of this situation and need to conduct themselves with an eye not just to their personal interest, but to the interest that all of us have in the integrity of the American political system and in the view that regular citizens like all of us who are here talking on the radio today or listening to it, we all have a stake in this, and it's a very big stake in how we feel about our American democracy. And these guys have some ability to impact that positively or negatively by how they deal with this situation. And so I hope and I fully expect that they will be adult senior political figures in our country and behave appropriately.
All right. Calvin Gilson, we've run out of time. I want to thank you for joining us today.
Happy to have done it. I enjoy it very much.
All right. Calvin Gilson is director of the Tower Center for Political Studies and chair of the Department of Political Science at Southern Methodist University. He joined us by phone from Texas. We thank you for joining us as well. Do want to give you one correction. There will not be a live press conference with Governor Jeb Bush about the Florida recount. The Associated Press is retracting that statement. Of course, we'll also want to remind you